Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. On the program this afternoon, preparing for the growing season, our guest is Chuck Voigt. We're going to talk with him this afternoon about herb and vegetable gardening. Chuck is Principal Research Specialist in Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois. He joins us from time to time during the growing season to answer our questions about herbs and vegetables. Chuck is co-author with J.S. Vandermark of the book Vegetable Gardening in the Midwest. The book is a publication of the Cooperative Extension Service. Listeners, you can join us with your questions about herbs and vegetables. We look forward to your telephone calls. Here are the telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Welcome back.
Always good to be here.
Always good to see you. Sure, harbinger of spring when I see you. And today it's kind of dreary out there, so it's a good day to talk about what we've got to look forward to.
Right. I think it'll be a while now before we have another real
blast of cold air.
No opportunity to work outside because it's muddy enough now that we're going to have to
wait till things dry up a little bit. Right. But we can dream, can't we?
Oh, we certainly can. Nothing better on a rainy day than dreaming.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when things do start to dry up a bit, what should we be doing out there in the garden to get ready for, you know, when we get into intensive planting season?
Well, if the sap hasn't risen within you in the last few weeks to go out and get everything cleaned up and ready to go, obviously that's something that needs to be done. And then soil preparation, all those kinds of things, when it gets dried out well enough, it certainly, before this rain, was, you know, dried out and in good shape to do that. And I'm sure some of our dedicated gardeners have some of the early crops planted. So when it dries out again, do that. And then get your cool weather things in because time's wasting. It'll be warm before we know it.
Okay, so we can already be doing cool weather crops, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Things like spinach, radishes, lettuce. We're getting to the point where we could probably plant potatoes. They might come up and get frosted a little bit before, things settle down, but that doesn't really seem to matter. You know, when they somehow overwinter in the soil and come up on their own as volunteers, you know, they may frost off a time or two, but they just seem to be so in tune with the season when they do that they go ahead and turn out pretty well anyway.
Yeah. Too early for peas?
No.
No. Okay.
No, peas are on that list too.
Okay. Very good. Now, we don't need at this point then, we don't need a cold frame for those crops?
No, not those really early things that we direct seed, you know, because there's going to be a week or 2 weeks delay between when we plant them and when they're up and actually vulnerable. And most of those things that we've talked about, and let's add onions and all their relatives, are real frost resistant anyway. So we're right in peak season for getting those guys in.
Okay. If we do have a cold frame, when can we be putting warmer weather things in there?
Well, usually we say 4 to 6 weeks before you want to put them outside. So I think if you're going to start peppers, you probably would want to have those going by about the 1st of April so that you can put them out toward the middle of May. Tomatoes, I find tomatoes grow pretty fast, so I would put them more toward the 4 week side of that and maybe hold off until, you know, the second week of April.
Tax day or something?
Tax day, you know, Easter's on the 11th this year, somewhere in that 11th to the 15th in that week, I think would be time enough to start tomatoes unless you're really competitive and really need to have that, you know, start a couple and get those going and have the fruits about two thirds grown and put those out and then you can claim all sorts of things. But for your main crop, I think starting them, you know, at the end of the first third of April would be adequate.
So then they can go into the garden around Mother's Day.
Yes.
Roughly. Okay.
Mother's Day to a week after Mother's Day, depending on how things feel by then.
Yeah.
Because you never know when one of those things is going to shoot down from Canada and nip them. I've had the surface of the soil frozen like on the 24th of May one year, which I had potatoes that were up about a foot at that point, and they really got creamed.
I was in Rockford one year, and it was the first week in May, and it was snowing. So
yep.
You never know. How long is a cold frame useful in the spring?
Well, probably as long as nights are cool, and as long as you're wanting to grow something that doesn't appreciate cool nights, it's useful for that. Certainly is useful even with some of the cool weather stuff to get them transferred from like a warm indoor environment, get them used to being more outside, sort of harden them off. Mm-hmm. The cold frame is the first step in that, and then ultimately you need to get them out into the full sun and those kinds of things.
Let's talk with a listener. We've got a caller waiting for us in Downs on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to continue the discussion about cold frames. I have two kind of plastic, well, I have some A-frames that I grow beans on, and I've covered them with plastic. I grew lettuce in them last fall, actually had lettuce in December, and some of it has wintered over. Now, I've planted some new in one of them, and I've kind of transplanted the other into that managed to winter over into sort of rows. When should I be taking that cover off of them, do you think?
Well, as long as the heat during the bright part of the day doesn't overpower them, I would leave it on because it's gonna move them along really nicely and store up that heat in the soil so that it stays nicely through the evening.
Okay.
I wouldn't be in a big rush, you know, unless we get to one of those April spells when the temperatures go up in the 80s or something.
Okay. I do open them during, you know, if it's sunny.
Then probably, you know, as long as we're getting frosts at night, you can leave the covers on. Because
okay. And then I also have some seeds started inside. This is the first year I've done that. When would you recommend moving those out into those frames?
Well, depending on what
they're... I've just got them started now. I mean, they're just coming up right now.
Right. Well, depending on how frost-resistant whatever it is you're growing from seed is...
Well, I've got the Mediterraneans, the tomatoes, peppers...
Okay, well, probably I would wait until mid-April, maybe,
okay.
if they're not getting too tall and scraggly in the meantime.
Right.
If they start doing that, you might, if it's not too much work, you could take them out during the daytime and
bring
then
them back.
Bring them back in at night just to so that they don't get nipped at some point. But
right. But once it's warm enough, if I can move them into a cold frame, I don't need to do that little dance in and out of the house.
I wouldn't think so, no, because especially if the sides are down toward the end of the day so it can build up a little bit of heat, usually there's enough in there to ward off all but, you know, some really nasty thing where we drop down into the 20s.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited. We're talking about urban vegetable gardening today with Chuck Voigt, preparing for the growing season, our topic this afternoon. Chuck is Principal Research Specialist in the Department of Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois. He joins us from time to time during the growing season to answer our questions about herbs and vegetables. Phone lines are open. No one waiting at the moment. 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. I've noticed that in our garden at home, we've got chives are coming up. They're looking real nice. Also, the lady's mantle has started to appear. What else is out there likely to be starting up? I was going to go out there this morning, and I thought, it's kind of drizzly and muddy, so I didn't do it. But I would imagine that there would be some other herbs starting to come
up. Well,
if
you followed my instructions last fall when I was on the program and got your garlic planted in the fall, as you should, that's up and growing just magnificently now. And it's just a beautiful sight to see your garlic and wonderful green rose at this season.
Yeah, I didn't do that.
Well, you'll probably have to rely on me for your garlic needs, or go to the farmer's market.
Yeah. You can't put that in at this point. It's too...
Well, you can. It's not going to perform as well as if you got it in the fall. The last couple of weeks when it was dried out, it would have been an ideal time to do that. So I'm telling you, you missed that opportunity. But it, you know, it would still grow. It would still produce. Certainly, if you have some garlic planting stock, if you put it in now, you can grow it up and harvest it as like garlic scallions, and that would still be magnificent.
Mm. Okay. During the Herb Day presentation, I wasn't able to go this year, but you had the garlic man on from California,
yes.
Right? How did that go?
Oh, it was great. I mean, he's a character. I mean, he's lived such a colorful life. He's been just about anything you can name in different careers. And fairly late in life, he got turned on to all the different garlics, starting with one that comes from the Georgian Republic, which actually is named after the town where his father emigrated from. So he felt a real connection to that one, and that sort of got him started. And now he's got, you know, like all those other plant collectors has tens of them,
yeah.
You know, 40 or 50 or, you know, however many varieties you can find is how many you yeah. feel like you need to have.
Now, does he have a mail order business, or what is his, or does he grow for the
He sells to local
California.
Restaurants,
yeah.
and I know he loves corresponding with people about things, and you can, you know, probably trade planting stock with him or something like that. I don't know that he has a business per se of marketing planting stock, because his operation is really pretty small. He has I think he had 20 like 4x20 planting boxes, and now he may have doubled those up, and he only has 10. So he can squeeze quite a bit of garlic into that, but not really a commercial level enterprise.
Mm, okay.
The reason he has to do that is gophers are just horrible out there. And if you don't fence them out, they'll take every bit of the garlic and he won't get anything.
Wow.
So we can be glad. There's at least one thing we don't have here that we could have that, that would be devastating.
Yeah. The rabbits and the squirrels are tough enough, you know.
But they usually only thin it out rather than just totally
destroying
it.
Yeah. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Caller waiting for us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a problem with raising peas. The house finch eat them. Now, they also like coal crops, but I cover them with a cloche. Do you have any way of managing that problem?
Well, have you ever tried the floating row cover kind of a product?
Well, that's what I use on cabbage, cauliflower, and broccoli, but the peas latch onto it, and it doesn't work very well.
Well, maybe I know sometimes we put it on with the hoops that give
yeah.
it some airspace above.
That's
so maybe if you can get it up where they can't get at it, that would be. That's the best thing I can think of to keep them away. You know, there's some sort of, or the other thing you could do is like possibly, I don't know, how tall, do you grow dwarf peas that don't need supports or taller peas?
I put them on a little fence.
Okay, well then, what would you think of looping like bird netting over that fence, the kind of thing you would put over a cherry tree or something, and just letting them grow through it?
If you could reach the peas.
Okay, there's a weak point in my reasoning. you know, you have to have some sort of a barrier is the only very effective way of keeping them away.
That's the way I figured, and so I quit raising peas, and I miss them.
Hmm. Is there some kind of a motion thing you could, you know, a whirligig or something you could put there to
Well,
kinda...
there's motion things, there's fake snakes, there's
yeah.
fake owls, but usually they get onto that pretty quickly.
That it's
not a dangerous snake or a dangerous owl. It's a dead one that's just standing there.
Mm-hmm. I thought there might be something you could spray on them, but I haven't heard of anything.
Well, then
you want to eat that. You don't want to eat
well,
what
it would have to be edible.
Right.
Yeah, there used to be a product that they put on like cherries and blueberries and things, but I'm not sure that's available anymore. It just gave it an off taste to the birds, but If that was ever available to homeowners, I don't believe it is anymore. You might try like a garlic and hot pepper spray. That certainly is edible. Mm-hmm. And might
work on rabbits.
Yep. I don't know if it'd work on birds or not, because
I don't either.
The hot pepper wouldn't, because birds don't sense that. They can eat hot peppers. But the garlic might offend them enough that they would leave it alone.
Well, we might have to give up growing peas as long as the house finch are here. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. What if this is a lot of trouble to go to you know, outsmart or outfox somebody like a something like a some creature like a finch? But you know, what if you used like a mesh or screening and you built yourself like a little screen box? You know, that's a lot of hassle to go through. But
right. Depends, you know, how much you miss peas.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, because you could even take like discarded window screens or make your own window screens and just set them up. I'm drawing a picture here for Celeste, if you can see that out there over the airway. Just sort of a long
a teepee kind of
like
thing.
Only two-sided teepee, just kind of lean them up against each other. And then if you wanted to pick the peas, you could open it up and be in good shape. Close it back up, put one on each end. That might be sufficiently perplexing to keep the birds out, at least mostly.
Yeah, and I suppose on the ends then, where you have the openings, you could cover.
Just stand another one up there. Depending on the wind situation, you might have to do some sort of support for it, but just generally, I think leaning on each other would be almost enough. Yeah. If you could put stakes down the row to lean them on.
Yeah. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon is Chuck Voigt. We're talking with him this afternoon about preparing for the growing season, talking about what we're going to put in the garden this year in terms of herbs and vegetables, and foiling the pests that are out there, keeping those birds, squirrels, and rabbits away from our lovely vegetables and herbs. What are you going to plant this year? Anything new, or do you pretty much have a routine now?
I'm kind of committed to sweet potatoes for at least one more year, so I'll probably grow about 40 varieties of those. I have 50 some varieties of garlic that I planted last fall that's in the system. Beyond that, I'm not so sure. You know, I'll fiddle around with 20 or so potato varieties just for old time's sake.
Now, why sweet potatoes for one more year?
Well, because I've been doing a replicated trial of them here, and the first 2 years, the results have been widely different, because the first year we had a really hot summer and they did really well. Last summer we had a pretty comfortable summer for humans, but not as much heat as the sweet potatoes would have liked. So they're only about half as good that second year. And so now I'd like to do it a third year to break the tie and come up with some sort of a workable average where you can sort of expect their production to be like.
Yeah. So far, what varieties have you found that work really well in this part of the country?
Well, the number one commercial variety is one called Beauregard. And there's a reason for that, because it sizes up roots really early. They're really attractive. They look like people expect sweet potatoes to look. They look like the sweet potatoes in the supermarket, because that's what most of them in the supermarket are. And it's really productive. So Beauregard is a really good one. Strangely, I found that the ones that are sold because of their dwarf vines, because they don't cover a lot of space, actually are not as early as some of the other ones that vine further. You know, the Bush Puerto Rico and the Vardaman tend to be a little later maturing than some of the others. So, plus the roots seem to spread out. The way the roots spread out versus the way the tops spread out, there doesn't seem to be a relation there. Some of them that the tops grow for 10 or 12 feet, you'll find that all the roots are compact, you know, like an octopus with swollen arms. And then you'll get something like a Bush Puerto Rico or a Vardaman, and you're 2 or 3 feet out away from the plant, and you're still cutting roots because they're just gone all over the place. And so I think sometimes they're sold based on the fact that they look nice and compact above the ground, but that doesn't necessarily translate into them being earlier for our northern gardens or easier to dig for our northern gardens.
Hmm. And in the way of herbs, doing anything out of the ordinary this year?
I'm just trying to get retrenched with probably get some additional lavenders planted out this year, just trying to see where we go. Not this winter, last winter, I lost a lot of the lavender that had been hardy for a few years, so need to keep looking at that and see if we can find some that are more dependable here. Chances are I'm going to lay off of basil this year because I've done that most of the years I've been here. I've looked at 20 or 30 basils, and I pretty much know what's out there right now, and we'll give that a rest until they come up with some more new ones.
Yeah. On the lavenders, are there some varieties that hold up in this part of the country better than others? What have you had good luck with?
Well, the old standbys, the Munstead and the Hidcote, I think are old standbys because they are a little more hardy. The downside to those two is that they don't get the nice long stems on the flowers that if you're going to do crafting or something with them, they're a little stubby for that. One called Marge Clark that was named for our friend
really?
Marge from Indiana. A fellow up in Michigan actually selected that one. And so it was actually selected at a location further north in here. And that is one of the lavendins that gets really nice long stems, a really dark purplish-blue flower. Really nice.
Yeah. It's such a nice plant in the garden. Whether you're using it for crafts or whether you're using it for cooking and that kind of thing, or, you just want something that's a handsome plant. It's a beautiful ornamental as well.
Even when it's not in flower, that gray foliage just makes a wonderful background for anything else you want to show up in front of it. I mean, gray just attracts light and diffuses the light, and it's those fuzzy, silvery plants are great.
And in the summer, if you happen to touch it, it's kind of refreshing.
Right.
Are there other herbs that make good ornamentals? Because basil's not a particularly, it's a great plant.
Some of the basils are used a lot in landscape settings. The purple ruffles is used a lot that way. Mm-hmm. The Siam queen is used that way. It gets that big purple cluster of bracts that show up well. Green ruffles. Some of the small ones,
the bushy ones,
the bush basils make nice little edgings and that sort of thing. So, basils are pretty ornamental. Trying to think what else is thymes. The only down thing I can see in thymes is that once they grow and spread out, they're annoying to try to weed because weeds start coming up through them, and it's hard to, you can't like hoe around a thyme because it's this mat of foliage.
There's an area in the yard that I've been thinking about. Maybe it would be nice to have a thyme path. But the weeds could be a problem?
Well, it might be the kind of thing where you could put down landscape fabric and just let it root through that, and the landscape fabric would allow that without allowing weeds to come up, because it's porous enough that you get a kind of a combination effect.
Yeah, I wonder if there would be a variety of thyme that you could just mow?
Most of them will stand a little bit of mowing, like they'll stand a little bit of foot traffic. And if they do come through the winter in good shape, it actually revitalizes them to go through like right before growth starts in the spring and mow them back to an inch or so that they just come shooting back out very vegetatively.
Let's talk about a thyme again here in just a moment, because it's a really nice plant, one of my favorites. Got to have thyme. A couple of different varieties in the garden. But first, I want to mention to the caller who called in about the peas. We have another possibility here. Someone called in to say that seagulls can be kept off boats by hanging, little triangular flags on strings or fishing lines, and that flapping kind of a thing. But you got to have a good breeze, I guess. Though that's the trouble with the whirligig idea as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it has to vary somehow, or birds seem to get used to any sort of noise or scary thing that you put there.
Yeah, they got more time than we do, too.
Yeah.
They can work on it.
They can be very diligent, where we tend to have other things in our lives that we need to do.
333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Chuck Voigt is our guest this afternoon. We're talking about getting ready for the growing season, about getting those herbs and vegetables going in the garden as it gets warmer here. Chuck is Principal Research Specialist in the Department of Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. And let's go back to the time question. Varieties I might want to consider for?
Well, for culinary, English is very good. Has the typical thyme flavor that we think of when we think of flavoring something with thyme. French is as good or better flavor, but it's a more upright plant and not really as hardy.
Okay.
So French is fine, but English is probably going to perform better for you year after year. If you want something that's going to be really flat that you put between paving stones on a path, then you want something flatter like a woolly thyme or a caraway thyme or white moss thyme, things that will never get more than about 2 inches tall no matter what you do to them.
Yeah. Are there some thymes that have flavors to them? I'm thinking, I know that I've grown lemon thyme, which is nice. Are there other kinds of?
Only hundreds.
I
mentioned caraway,
right.
Lemon. There's several different kinds of lemon. There's a green leaf lemon. There's a variegated leaf lemon. There's a Dune Valley lemon, lemon carpet, orange balsam. It's herbs have been, thymes and mints and some of the other scented geraniums have been selected to mimic so many of the other scents and flavors that it's amazing.
Mm. Herbs in pots, herbs in window boxes, what works well?
Most anything. Certainly in some kind of containers, the things that aren't fully hardy here, like lemon verbena, like rosemary, like some of the tender lavenders, would be great in a container, because then you could at least make a token effort to bring them in the winter.
Yeah.
and most herbs, or a lot of the herbs that we use are Mediterranean. So, if you put them in a pot on the patio, they think they've died and gone back to the homeland where the sun beats down on them and
they're happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are there any herbs or some that will tolerate a little bit of shade?
Thyme is one
that
tolerates some shade. After that, the list goes down fairly rapidly. I'd say just don't be afraid to try things in terms of, if just because it says full sun doesn't mean it won't survive and produce in a semi-shady location. It just won't be as good. Or it may be more susceptible to some problems or something. But it never hurts to try.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think of the products that are out there for window boxes and hanging planters and pots that are designed to hold water? What do you think of those?
I think it probably does cut down the time or lengthens the amount of time you can go between waterings, and that's probably not a bad thing to have in your containers, as you go through the summer and may want to be away for a week at a time or something. Mm. and don't have a friend that you can really trust to do it the way you tell them. So they seem to be pretty inert polymer. Uh-huh. Kinds of things that just soak it up and get
it.
Kind of a jello-like consistency.
Ah,
and
okay.
And I know some of the commercial growers that I know just fairly routinely work that into the pots that they put together. So
yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I just bought a couple packets of seeds for tomatoes, and on the packages it said not to plant tomatoes, potatoes, eggplant, or closely related, or any plants closely related to them in the same area where they've been grown before. Do you know anything about that? I've never heard that.
Ideally, you don't want to plant things from the same plant family in the same location more often than once in 4 years. And when we get into a backyard garden situation, that doesn't really turn out to be a practical thing. So we just kind of recommend that you try not to do it year after year. And because they are closely related, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants,
potatoes
are all nightshades. As are petunias and some other things. So they're going to be subject to, you know, similar diseases, similar insects. And it just makes it too easy for the pests if you have them in the same location year after year.
Like how far apart is not the same location?
Well, if you had a 4x8 raised bed, you know, do it in the west half 1 year and in the east half the other year. You have to kind of do the best you can, and the longer I'm here, the better I get at being that way. You know, when I started out on the farm, you know, I could rotate literally a quarter of a mile away if I needed to, and we just don't have that capability on our 3 or 4 tenths acre lots in town. So just do the best that you can, and you know, maybe make a diagram of what you've done the previous year so that you know once they're pulled out it gets hard to remember where things were last year.
Yeah, do they need they all like full sun, do they?
Sure. Uh-huh. Yeah, anything where you mature fruit on the plant pretty much needs full sun. Things that you eat while they're leafy, like lettuces and spinaches and those kinds of things, can get by with probably as little as 6 hours of sunlight a day, but when you get into things like corn and beans and tomatoes and those kinds of things, they pretty much need 8 or more hours of sunlight, and full sun is the preferable amount.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
Good luck. Next, we talk with a listener on line 4 in Mattoon. Hi.
Hi. I wonder what your guest would thank you for the show, but I wonder what your guest would think about trying to grow a zucchini in a large pot. I'm short of space this year, and I wondered if I could do that.
It depends a little bit how large you mean by large, but certainly in a half whiskey barrel planter.
Yeah, I've got a couple of big ones.
Yeah, I think in that size range you'd do fine.
Would I need to put up a little something for it to climb on?
Well, zucchini is a bush squash, so it pretty much supports itself. You know, if it survives for several months, sometimes they lengthen out enough so it might droop over the edge. But they're usually pretty good at holding themselves up. If you notice a problem, you might want to prop it up a little bit with something. But by and large, they take care of themselves pretty well.
Yeah, maybe some of those little I forget what they call them, those little flat ones, instead of the long zucchini, you know, those little, there's a little flat squash.
Oh, like a patty pan?
Yeah,
or
patty pan, that's it.
Sure.
Maybe that would work.
Well, they grow on pretty much the same plant, so I would just grow the one that you want, whether that's a black zucchini or a yellow zucchini or a yellow crookneck or, you know, whatever. Uh-huh. Whatever one you like the best, and you know, give it a shot in the container. As long as the container's out in full sun and you do regular pest control on it and keep the water and fertility in line, I think you can grow zucchini in a large container.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Sure.
Okay.
Bye.
Good luck. Fertilizer. When do you apply it? I'm suspecting that in this case, in a container, you'd really want to keep up on that, huh?
Right. I would mix some sort of balanced fertilizer in whatever the medium you have, the growing medium is, in the container when you start, and then with something like zucchini that are pretty heavy feeders of nitrogen, you'd want a side dress with something that's fairly high in nitrogen, you know, as the plant is about, starts to get full size and as it starts to produce fruit, every couple of weeks maybe.
Okay.
Give it a little booster shot.
Okay. Let's talk with a listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hello, I'm calling from Urbana. I'd like some information. I'd like to start my own tomato plants with seed. What's the best kind of soil to use? Excuse me. Go ahead now.
Well, normally I would recommend that you buy just a bagged seed starting mix.
Seed starting mix, okay.
If you can find that, just any of the peat light mixes that are mixes of peat and either vermiculite and or perlite, to something very light. The ones for seed starting usually have just a little bit of fertility in them so that they can get the seeds off to a good start.
Mm-hmm.
They drain really well. They're materials that are more or less sterile as they come so that you don't have to worry about sterilizing the medium to avoid damping off diseases in the seedlings.
I gotcha.
So if you can find a nice bag of some sort of seed starting medium, that's what the only difference between that and what I use over at the university greenhouses would be that we get it in bigger bags.
Okay, I appreciate it. I put that in a plastic cup with a couple of holes in the bottom, something like that.
Sure. Yeah. Depending on what you're growing, some people will recycle egg cartons.
Yeah, no, that's an idea. I hadn't thought.
Like you sort of have that same individual thing as you would.
Right.
In a,
right. Okay.
And you know, depending on how many you want to do, you can buy plastic flats with a 72 cell insert pretty cheaply.
Well, I need about six or eight.
Well, then recycle those deli containers or egg cartons or whatever. You know, I'm a big fan of garbage picking myself.
I'll just find some styrofoam cups here and there, and it'll set me up just fine. Thanks for the help.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. Bye bye. Not all of us can do 60 or 70 tomato plants, Chuck.
Well, I talk about how many flats I'm going to do, so you have to kind of calm my enthusiasm.
Again, how many varieties of sweet potato are you doing this year?
I have 40-ish.
40-ish. Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line 3. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm interested in what they call a soil moist pellet or something. And I want to know, would it be advisable to put these things in when you plant rose bushes in with the roots?
Where are you?
In Champaign.
Our soil is so moisture retentive here. I tend more to try to put those things in container soils.
Okay.
Any sort of native soil that we have here is you usually try to convince it to drain, not to hold more water. So
my beds are raised beds where I'm going to plant them.
Okay. Still.
If it
has the native clay loam soil in it, I would question whether you need that in there.
It's more like for potted plants then.
It is, or I think some people that come. I grew up in very sandy soil, and it might, add enough water-holding capacity to something like that that it would be helpful. But I have more trouble with the soil being too wet here than I do with it being too dry, at least except for that week or two in the summer when we get a heat wave and it doesn't rain. But I can foresee more problems from doing that in Champaign than benefits.
All right, thank you. I'll save $20.
There you go.
Okay, we'll split it.
Bye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, on those, that's my question too with the containers. And I have some containers that are terracotta, and then I have some that are plastic. And the plastic one, sometimes it just seems, you can get a good rain and then it's wet for a while, and I'll be out there, I'll hear the thunder, and then I'm off, down the walk trying to lift the plastic pots up and put them in some shelter because it's too wet. But I would imagine then these moisture holding products would be better for terracotta.
Yes.
Something where you're going to have a lot of evaporation and
right.
you're going to be out in the sun baking those
right.
plants.
Right. And to some extent, it would help if you have a little garden experience with whatever you're going to be growing in the pot so that you know if it dries out faster than you can water it, you know, like if you can only water once a day and it dries out twice a day, that would be a really good situation to incorporate some of that so you get a little more capacity to go for a longer time. Yeah, if you're in plastic pots which don't evaporate water through the pot and you're already having problems with it being damp, then that's a pretty clear situation where you wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah, but you know, even with the plastic pot, sometimes it gets so hot out there in the sun that you gotta stay on top of the watering.
Right.
But the terracotta ones, you really gotta, you know.
Well, and sometimes people get potting mixes that are made out of a sedge peat, a muck peat, that's very black, and people associate black with good.
Yeah.
And some of those are not that productive. They tend to stay wet. They tend not to exchange nutrients correctly. So sometimes, at least for these situations, the regular sphagnum peat, the brown peat, a browner soil mix, if you will, would be better than some of these really black ones that we get where we mistake it for the black mineral soils that we have here. And it some of those can really give you fits when you put them in a container.
Okay. Let's talk with a listener on a car phone, line 4. Hi.
Hi. Is there anywhere that you can get the soil temperatures through, like, the weather stations or anything like that that ever broadcast what the current soil temperatures are, and specifically in the Chicago area? Do you know anything about that?
We were right with you until you said Chicago area.
Well, anywhere then.
Well, down here, the TV stations will actually, at least on one of the many news programs, usually will give the soil temperature at the 4-inch level and the 8-inch level. I think that's probably because their audience still includes farmers. You're not going to have that in the Chicagoland area because up there you get forecasts where rain is always a bad thing no matter when it comes, and it's a different situation. If you contact, like, the Illinois Water Survey, I think would be able to have those numbers.
I wonder if they, on their website, if they'd have it available. Also, in the morning, on the pre-opening commodity market report, which is at 8:50 Central Time, when Ed does his agricultural weather forecast, in that break, I believe he might give the soil temperatures, and then also in the last weathercast in morning edition, which comes up after the 9:30 news at 9:35, they give statistics there.
Okay, and that's right here on WILL.
Right.
Okay, and then the only problem with that for you would be that we're downstate and we're probably going to be anywhere from a week to 2 weeks
warmer
and ahead of what you are up in the Chicago area.
Okay.
So you might have to estimate downward from what you hear here in Champaign, but at least it'll give you some idea of where we might be.
And there wouldn't be any kind of garden, you know, there's a lot of gardening interest in the Chicago area. There wouldn't be anything.
Well,
you know what? I would check with your gardening center because those people who are up there in planting, the nursery men and women are going to know what the soil temperatures are.
Right. Okay. Or you, the U of I Extension people up there might be able to help you too.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye.
Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana, line 1. Hi. It'll have to be quick because we're running down on time here.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to prepare a new piece of ground there. It's about 20 feet by 20 feet, so a fairly large garden. And it has not been a garden before. In fact, there's some horses that are standing on it right now. So it's pattered down pretty good, and it has a lot of load of manure in there.
Okay.
What do we dig into that to make it nice and fluffy?
Well, the horse manure is a good start.
Okay.
and just digging it up will help to fluff it. I would actually, are you familiar with double digging?
No.
Okay, it's pretty simple. I'll try to explain it quickly since we're up against the markets here. You would just start at one side of that bed, dig a shovel deep, throw it into a wheelbarrow or something, and keep that off to the side. And then you go down where you've just dug that furrow and, and dig that up again and flip it over.
Oh.
And that aerates it. And you know, if you have any extra horse manure or something, you could work it into that too to get as much organic matter involved as possible. And then you just do that, you know, in like shovel wide widths the whole length of this 20 by 20.
Would using a big tiller do the same thing?
Well, it won't get you down as deep.
Okay.
So when you're starting out, especially if it's been really compacted by these horses tramping on it for any length of time, it would really be a good thing to do that. If it's a lot of work, so if you can sort of figure out where your planting beds are going to go, you could only do the planting beds that way and save some of the backbreaking labor of it. But really getting that air back into the soil is really important. Plus you would get the organic matter from the horse manure and whatever incorporated into the whole soil profile versus just tilling it into the surface. If that all sounds like too much work, just get a good tiller and till it several times in several different directions and that's not optimal, but it's certainly going to get you going.
You just want to get it down deeper. We could even get a friend with a plow or something to maybe plow it up.
Well, yeah, just
or something.
Yep, I think you're on the right track, and the more organic matter, the better, and the more aeration you can get back into the soil, the better.
Okay, that's where we'll have to leave it. Chuck, thanks a lot. We'll look forward to talking with you again in the near future. Chuck Voigt, Principal Research Specialist in the Department of Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, Todd Gleason is in today to do the settlements. Todd.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade today, futures in the bean pit finished the day a bit mixed. We'll talk with Dan Zwicker of AgriVisor Services in Normal, Illinois this afternoon about the commodity markets and what's been happening the last couple of days. We've been out, as you probably are well aware, but we've got commodity markets today and back on our regular schedule. We'll be talking to Dan at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time today. Let's take a look at what happened at the grains floor. The wheat futures were lower. That's said to be on being pushed down following the corn and the beans. May futures, 413 and 3 quarters high for the day. The low at 404 and a quarter. Settlement price at 408, down 4 cents. July, 417, the high. The low at 407 and a half. And a settlement price at 412. They were down 4 on the day. September wheat, 419, the high. The low at 411 and a half. A settlement price at 415 and a half. 3 and a half lower. And December futures, 426, the high. The low at 417. A settlement price at 422 and a quarter. They finished 3 lower for the day. The March futures in the wheat pit, 425, the high. The low at 419. And a settlement price at 422, down 4 for the day. From the corn pit, futures finished the day lower. May contract 311 and 3 quarters on the high. The low at 305 and a half. A settlement price at 306 and 3 quarters, down 2 and 3 quarters. I was on the farm yesterday in Logan County, Illinois. That's near Springfield. And guess what I saw? A planter putting corn in the ground yesterday afternoon. They're not there today, of course, because of the rain, but the planters are running in parts of the world. July futures in the corn pit now, 317 the high, the low at 310. A settlement price, 311 and a half, down 3 1/4. And the September futures in the corn pit, 313 and a half, the high, the low at 306 and a half. A settlement price at 307, down 5 for the day. December futures in the corn pit, 310 and 3 quarters, the high, the low at 302. Settlement price at 302 and a half, down 6 and a quarter. In the March contract, 312 and a half, the high, the low at 304 and a half. And a settlement price at 305, down 5.5 cents for the day. May futures, 314, the high, the low at 307. A settlement price there at that low, 307, down 4.5. And July's, 314, the high, the low at 307. A settlement price for the July 05 contract, down 4.5 cents. December 05, 271, the high, the low at 268 and a quarter. Settlement at 268 and a half, down 2. May oats, 169, the high, the low at 163. A settlement price at 167, a penny and a half higher. And July futures, 174 and a half, the high, the low at 167, a settlement price at 171. They were up 0.5 cent for the day. From the soy complex now, the nearby May bean contract, 10.39 the high, the low at 10.16. Settlement price at 10.28.5. They finished 5 cents higher, but the July was lower for the day. 10.32 the high, the low at 10.06. The settlement price at 10.16.75, down a quarter. And the August beans, 10.04 the high, the low at 9.74 in the August. 9.86 down six, the settlement price there. September futures, 8.93 the high, the low at 8.74. Settlement price 7.5 lower at 8.78.5. November, a little bounce there, but still a loser for the day. 7.93 the high, the low at 7.74. Up off that low at 7.78.75 on a settlement price, down 4.25 in the January. 7.86.5 the high, the low at 7.73. A settlement price at 7.76.5, down 6.5 cents. March soybeans, 7.80 the high, the low at 7.67. A settlement price at 7.73. They were down 7 for the day. The May bean meal at 3.22 on the high, the low at 3.13.5, or rather 3.13.50, and a settlement price at 3.19.70. They were up 1.90. July meal, 3.20.50 the high, the low at 3.12. Settlement price at 3.18.10, down, or rather up 2.30 for the day. May bean oil, 34.20 the high, the low at 33.47, and a settlement price at 33.70, down 20 in the July oil in the products. 33.95 the high, the low at 33.25, a settlement price at 33.49. They finished down 19. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Prices higher today on the Mercantile Exchange. March feeder cattle, 90.70 the high, 90.62.5 the low, 90.62.5 the settlement, that up 15. April, 88 even the high, 87.45 the low, 87.95 the settlement, that up 37.5. May, 86.40 the high, 85.55 the low, 85.92.5 the settlement, that up 17.5. August, 87.45 the high, 86.80 the low, 87.45 the settlement, that up 20. March live cattle, 81.10 the high, 81 even the low, 81 even the settlement today, that down 70. April, 77.77.5 the high, 76.62.5 the low, the settlement 76.75, that down 62.5. June, 73.40 the high, 72.60 the low, the settlement 73.10, that up 17.5. August, 73.90 the high, 73.22.5 the low, 73.42.5 the settlement, that up 7.5. April lean hog, 66.90 the high, 65.25 the low, 66.67.5 the settlement, that up 85. May, 67.25 the high, 65.90 the low, 67.22.5 the settlement, that up 90. June, 72.10 the high, 69.97.5 the low, 71.65 the settlement, that up 132.5. July lean hog, 68.20 the high, 66.75 the low, 68.15 the settlement, that up 92.5. Let's see, let's take a look at the bellies now. And bear with me here for just a moment because the numbers are all running together today here on the screen. Okay, March pork bellies, 110 even the high, 108 even the low, and 110 the settlement, settling up with 300. May bellies, 106 even today's high, 104.05 today's low, and they finish today at 105.95.